Good morning and welcome to Atheist Talk on KTNF AM 950, the voice of Minnesota. We appreciate all of you for tuning into the show. Today is Sunday, October the 24th, 2010, and I'm your host, Mike Hobrick. I am in the studio with Lynn Fellman and Greg Layden. This is just amazingly exciting to introduce our guest today. We welcome listener interaction during the live show with your phone calls to 952-946-6205 or your emails to radio at minnesotaatheist.org. Ira Flatow is our guest today. Ira is the host for NPR Science Friday. Greg, who is an investigator into anthropology and human origins, and Lynn, who communicates science through art, will be talking to Ira about the current state of science communication and what else can be done to communicate and popularize science. Greg, Lynn, and Ira, welcome to Atheist Talk.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling in from New York this morning.
You're welcome.
Now, Greg and I are going to trade off with our questions, and I'll start first. But I have two quick stories. We love your Minnesota connection. One of my multimedia pals just recently told me about working at our public television station, which is KTCA, during Newton's Apple. And that's when you hosted and you wrote for Newton's Apple. And it was produced, like I said, right here in Minnesota. And it's that terrific show for kids. And every adult I know loves it, too. And he said he has such good memories working with you on that show.
Oh, I have great memories of that show, too. I love that program. I did that for about 6 or 7 years. And Minnesota and the Twin Cities sort of became my second home at that time.
Oh, I remember some folks saying that. That you still have a lot of good friends here. So come back and visit us sometime soon.
Absolutely.
Okay, just and one other story, too, that so one of your staff people called, you know, doing the research behind the scenes, called the University of Minnesota professor and asked something like, how much DNA in a person? The idea being, you know, you wanted to make it real to people. And he told me ever since then he's used that those factoids that you guys came up with in his classes because it gave people such a good idea. It was, I think one of the ones was, you know, in every cell of our body there's 6 feet of DNA or something like that. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, if you stretch it all out, it goes on for a long, long time. I mean, it's very tiny, very small, but it's all folded up in there.
Yeah, and you know, and that wonderful way that you have of communicating, you know, these difficult concepts and combining, it really is a wonderful combination of science and humanities, is so unique and terrific. And so here's my question finally is, did you, like, think that way when you were a kid, or did you have a mentor that helped you?
That's a great question. I always wanted to know how things work. I used to take things apart. I used to be this kid in the basement, you know, blowing things up, stuff with chemistry sets, all that kind of thing. And I always, you know, more than how things were, if you want to understand how things are constructed, you have to take them apart, see how they work. And I got that opportunity when I was in grade school, and I had a seventh grade teacher, Mrs. Pfeffer, who had a science club after school, and she encouraged us all to stay after and work on real projects. And I used to take those projects home, and I believe to this day, and I think if you ask a lot of successful scientists what, you know, what helped them in their careers, and they'll usually tell you there was some adult, there was some teacher, some mentor, some friend, some uncle, some somebody who helped them along.
Oh, so you had a Mrs. Fetzer. That's a terrific story.
Yeah.
Ira, this is Greg. Nice to meet you telephonically.
Thank you.
You also have, you know a lot about science, obviously, and you have a very strong orientation towards science, but you're also talented and as an engineer, as a performer, someone who can actually go before the public and capture their attention and so on. Did you also start early with acting and or performance or anything along those lines? Did you have any early influences along those lines as well?
Well, when I was in high school, you know, I was in high school and we were reading in 11th grade, just like you do in class, we were reading plays. And we were reading Arthur Miller plays, Death of a Salesman and others. And my high school teacher said, you know, called me over after school, after class, and I thought I was going to be held for detention or something. I said, what did I do wrong? And she said, you didn't do anything wrong. You actually were really good in reading, you know, the parts and the plays. I think you should try out for the high school play. I said, me? She said, yeah. And so the senior class play, I tried out for it. It was Rally Round the Flag Boys, and I got the lead. And I really got very interested in the theater from that day on. And I guess the ham part of me came out, and that actually was useful in being a science communicator and helping me in my work as a journalist, because I was really not afraid to stand up in front of an audience and talk about science, and that audience got to be bigger, which was a radio program, over a million listeners, and podcasts, you know, bigger than that. So I look upon that, the ability to communicate starts out with having self-confidence in front of an audience, and if you want to be a good communicator, you have to learn how to do that.
Oh, boy, that's a good story of another teacher, though, that saw some real gift
exactly.
there. Yeah, and helped you to develop. So then, like, what did Mom and Dad say about that?
Well, my father, I always wanted to be, as you say, I always wanted to be an engineer, and I never really was an engineer, and it's good for the engineering community that I never really joined them.
Okay.
Although I did get inducted into the Connecticut Academy of Engineering a few years ago. I always wanted to be an engineer, and I was really surprised that after my father had seen me in this high school play, he said, gee, did you ever think about going into studying drama or something like that? And I, wow, you could have blown me away when he said that. And when I went to college, I went to SUNY Buffalo. They didn't have a journalism department. I was studying engineering there. And I tried out for one of their plays, and it was an awful tryout. And it was one of the turning points in my life, because since I did not get involved with the theater, I got involved with radio.
Okay.
And it happened to be in the right place at the right time for the genesis of National Public Radio.
Okay. So thinking about, you know, the KTCA experience with Newton's Apple and those early experiences you had just really on the stage, recently was that cameo role you had in The Big Bang Theory, which was, and that was terrific. So tell us about that, but then maybe talk a little bit more, too, about over the course of these last 20 years or so, the role of, really, I guess we could say show business in science, communicating science.
Well, okay, yeah, it's an interesting period we're living in now, and the Big Bang Theory, I think, is indicative of it. The Big Bang Theory is one of the most popular programs on CBS, and it features these nerdy roommates, these nerdy physicists who speak just like geeks. They call them geeks today, and they're in their own little community and in their own little apartment building, and they talk about physics all the time. In between trying to get dates, they talk about physics. And it's real physics, and it's real science, and they have a science advisor that makes sure that the science that they talk about is accurate. And I got a call from the producer, one of the producers of the program a few months ago, saying, we want to create a scenario in the program where Sheldon, who's one of the lead characters, I think he just got an Emmy, is on a science talk show, and we couldn't think of anyone but you, and would you mind recreating or creating part of Science Friday that he could be a guest on?
Oh,
so I said,
great.
Sure. So we created a little segment for Sheldon on television, and it was part of the TV show, and it played a little trick on him, and it was a lot of fun. And I think this is indicative of a good trend that we're seeing, and that is that television, and not just TV, but theater and other arts, as you know, you're involved in science and the arts, it's becoming very popular. For many, many years, scientists would try to convince the TV world or the Hollywood world to include science themes in their TV shows. Leon Letterman, who was a Nobel physicist, used to go out to Hollywood every year for 20 years, talk to Norman Lear, the guy who invented All in the Family and a very big Hollywood producer, to say, look, if you're going to do a show, why can't you just do it in a laboratory instead of doing it in, you know, a hospital or something? And he was never really able to convince them to do it. And suddenly we're now seeing, you know, the generation of where these, the laboratories are now turning out to be crime investigative units instead of, you know, in a regular university laboratory. And there's always a little bit of science in these crime investigation shows. And then the producer of Big Bang Theory says, hey, you know, let's see if we can put this as a TV drama, exactly of the kind of stuff that people were asking about years ago, and look how popular it is. In fact, the time that Science Friday was on the Big Bang Theory, we outdrew Two and a Half Men, which was produced by the same people, and it was the most popular show that night on CBS.
Excellent.
So,
yay.
I don't take any credit for that. So I want you, don't want to get that wrong, but well, we're very proud of that fact, and I think there is, science has been discovered. I think it's because of the high-tech age we're in. People are having more fun looking at people who are scientists or technologists and appreciating them for their talents.
I think you're so right, and I always check the screens on the that they're looking at on their to see, you know, the PCR readout and to see how accurate some of those and their terms that they use when they're talking about DNA. It's in our DNA is everywhere.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah, and we're just moving into a break here, Ira and I. When we come back, Greg Layden will have a little more to say, too, about some of the new media. He has a blog, and you have a blog, and we'll talk about that in just a few seconds when we come back.
All right. Please stay with us through the break, and we will return to Atheist Talk. I am Mike Harbuck, and you are listening to AM 950 KTNF, the voice of Minnesota, with Ira Flato, Greg Layden, and Lynn Feldman.
Baby steps. That's how the religious right has quietly gotten hundreds of laws passed in Washington. Little laws that sound so technical, so minute, people haven't noticed. But we notice, and we fight back. We're the Secular Coalition for America. We monitor and lobby against efforts to turn our nation's laws into religious laws, laws that undermine medical research, access to birth control, and to the courts, to force religious education on our children, and to rob them of basic knowledge about biology, evolution, and sexuality, laws that make special exceptions for religious groups, that give them special privileges no one else gets, all with taxpayer dollars, your dollars, faith-based programs, marriage amendments, school vouchers. They've spent decades remaking our government in their image. Now we're fighting back and winning. You can join us. Go to secular.org. Get the latest news. Sign up for our action alerts. Get active. Join the fight. We are the Secular Coalition for America.
Hi, my name is Mickey McCabe, and I'm the owner of Cucumbers Restaurant at 75th and Francine Dinah. If you've never been to Cucumbers, it's a buffet-style restaurant with a huge variety of salads, homemade soups, bakery items, and hot entrees that change daily and nightly, plus our always fresh fruit and delicious ice cream. We're open for lunch and dinner, but Sunday brunch is my favorite time at Cucumbers. With scrambled eggs, waffles, French toast, bacon, sausage, baked ham, chicken fajitas, brunch potatoes, warm gooey cinnamon rolls, and many other items to choose from, it's no wonder why Cucumbers has always been a popular Sunday destination. So whether you're looking to skip Mass, someplace to go after Mass, or just great food to maintain your Mass, Cucumbers is the answer to your prayers. Bring in your church bulletin or Minnesota Atheist newsletter and receive a $2 discount off the buffet price. Cucumbers, one heavenly buffet at 75th and France in Edina.
Welcome back to AM 950 KTNF, the voice of Minnesota. This is Atheist Talk, and I am your host, Mike Harbrick. Today, Greg Layden and Lynn Feldman are talking to Ira Flato. Ira, Lynn, and Greg, welcome back to the Atheist Talk Show.
Hi, Ira. This is Greg. I think it might be interesting to talk a little bit about the way science is represented in the media and how science gets communicated in some more detail. And I was wondering, you know, you had a very... a series of popular science outlets, science shows, and Science Friday is obviously kind of a keystone event for most people in their week who are interested in science. But what do you think about the changes that have happened in communication over the last 2 years or so in the blogosphere? I mean, do you think the science blogosphere is an important phenomenon? Do you think it's it has costs, it has benefits? What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there are pluses and minuses in it. The pluses are that people will be exposed to many, many more topics in science than they normally would. The blogosphere brings up issues, discusses issues, brings up topics that people may, you know, that are left out by the quote-unquote normal media, meaning the broadcast media, cable, television, things like that, because they just don't cover very much science or technology. On the other hand, you have to be very careful about which blogosphere, which blog you're paying attention to, because just like in newspapers, magazines, and television, some bloggers are better than other bloggers, and some sources are more trustworthy than other sources. You have to figure out and decide and do some research, some homework, to figure out who you would trust and who really doesn't have any experience, who has been doing this, who's been doing science reporting or journalism for a while and is now, you know, now has a blog. And that's always been true of newspapers, whom, you know, which newspaper would you trust, or magazines or networks or cable channels. But there are so many bloggers out there, and so many things change so quickly that it's a little more difficult to keep track.
I think an interesting event happened last year, which was probably something someone should write their master's thesis on, at least, when the famous primate fossil Ida was announced. And at the same time that the species was named and announced, the popular book on it was also released at the same exact moment. And it was also claimed to be a missing link, which is a standard term people use in science communication. And the blogosphere reacted to that very negatively. And in fact, the term missing link is now pretty much taboo, because so many people in the blogosphere explained, I think mostly incorrectly, why it's not a term you should ever use in science. But I was wondering about, you know, the problem here is the nature of the outlet itself has an influence on the kind of communication that happens. So there we see the scientists controlling the outlet of information in a way that they would maximize publicity, the blogosphere being very reactionary to that. And in between that, we have things like your show or produced, you know, National Geographic specials, in which there's thoughtfulness and care put into something. What do you think about the tension between publicly funded versus commercially funded outlets of science communication?
Well, I think that trend is following the news business in general. I mean, science news and science journalism is sort of a subset of the general state of the affairs of the news business. And the commercial news business, broadcasting news business, and the blogosphere, but broadcasting more now, is really not involved in educating you. Their job is not to make you a better citizen or to give you more knowledge. It's more to just entertain you. And there's nothing wrong with entertainment. I mean, that's how a lot of us learn, and if you make one, that's what I try to do with science, to make it entertaining. But they're trying to make it politically entertaining. They're trying to create a food fight, trying to to polarize issues. Instead of actually illuminating it, they're trying to create more heat than light. And that is a difficult problem, because if you're not going to get any real sources of enlightenment from the commercial news media, whom do you turn to? And that's where we have to think about turning toward the public sector, toward more funded news sources that come from foundation funding, people who are sitting on the outside who don't have this entertainment bent, but who really do believe in the idea of good journalism and knowledge. And I think that is a trend that we're seeing now, and we don't know how that's going to shake out, but you know, hopefully that will take the place of what used to be the trusted sources of news.
Do you think there's a role that our traditional educational systems have in this? I mean, should science classes include direct reference to the media? I mean, should science teachers be talking to students about how to pick and choose and evaluate the sources that they are exposed to on cable TV and so on?
You know, we talk about the word science. When you might want to substitute the word science, you might want to substitute critical thinking. We should be teaching critical thinking, and science is part of critical thinking. Teaching students how to analyze things, how to analyze the sources, where do they come from. You know, there's a very famous film called The Private Universe, and it was made about 10 or 15 years ago, and they took a camera to Harvard University's graduation, and they stuck a camera up in front of all the graduating students, and they're in their caps and gowns, they asked them one question, and that was, why is it hotter in the summer than it is in the winter? And 90%, 30 out of 32, I think, the figure, of all these Harvard four-year graduating students got it wrong. No, only two out of those 32 knew why it's hotter in the summer than in the winter. And they made a film out of it. And most of them said the normal expected thing, which is because the Earth is closer to the sun in the summertime than it is in the wintertime. Now, if you had studied, you know, even some of the science majors, the astronomy majors, got them wrong. But if you had understood critical thinking and you had thought critically about it, you might say, well, how can that be? Because why is it wintertime in Australia then, if it is summertime where we are? And you would be able to figure out that it's the tilt of the Earth. That's why, you know, the seasons happen versus, you know, being closer to the sun when, in fact, we have basically a circular orbit around the sun. So if we really need to teach critical thinking for every topic. And so you can critically think about science, you can critically think about evolution, you can critically think about global warming. You can learn how to analyze and think for yourself and gather the facts and make your own decisions.
Yeah, I was teaching at Harvard at the time, but I did not teach meteorology, so I have nothing to do with that at all. Mike, did we have a question from the audience?
Yeah, we have. And, we're getting right into the break, so I'll let Ira think about it and answer when we come back from the break. This is from Steve in Shoreview. Carl Sagan was one of the first to communicate science to the general population, and many scientists consider him a heretic, but his influence is vital to the evolution of science education in America. Ira, do most scientists today consider pop culture communicators a nuisance or a benefit? And with that, we'll go to a break. You're listening to AM 950 KTNF, the voice of Minnesota Radio, and you're listening to Atheist Talk. Thank you.
Humanists, I've noticed, tend to be curious about the world. Hi, I'm Scott Lohman, president of the Humanists of Minnesota. Some great things have come from asking questions, like, do you think we will continue to learn more about our world's past, present, and future? Or do you feel that our environment needs to be taken care of and protected for the future generations of humans? Or do you believe that the meaning of life is that which we give to it? If these are questions you found yourself asking, then you might be a humanist. The Humanists of Minnesota are a group of humanists, agnostics, atheists, and religious humanists out to learn answers to those questions. Humanists believe that we as human beings can find answers to our own problems. You can find out more about us by going to our website at humanistsofmin.org. That's humanistsofmn.org, or call us at 651-335-3800. The responsibility for our world and our lives is ours and ours alone.
Atheists, secular humanists, and free thinkers. Here you are listening to the Minnesota Atheists Talk Radio Show, Atheist Talk. We hope you are enjoying it. If having a frankly atheist perspective on the radio waves appeals to you, please consider making a contribution to our radio fund. Our contract came up for renewal, and we need your help if you want the program to stay on the air. That will make sure that you can continue to have opportunities to hear interesting speakers with non-religious perspectives, and you can call up and ask them questions too. Get the details on our website at minnesotaatheists.org, where you will find buttons to make it easy to make a secure donation through PayPal. Or, if you have a business and would like to reach an intelligent, progressive audience, please contact us through our website. That's MinnesotaAtheists.org. Or call us at 612-588-7031. If you are interested in us, we are interested in you.
Science in the 21st century is far more accessible than it ever has been. New media options seem to be springing up each week. iPod, Android apps, blogs, Twitter, podcasts, and far more. Scientific articles are now published openly on places like Public Library of Science, and so that non-scientists can read original articles. Ira Flatow, host of NPR Science Friday, is on the front of many of these waves, communicating the heck out of scientists. Local science communicators Greg Layden and Lynn Filman are joining Ira to discuss science in the public forum. Welcome back to Atheist Talk on AM 950 KTNF, the voice of Minnesota. If you have questions or comment, please call us at 952-946-6205 or email to radio at minnesotaatheist.org. Ira, Greg, and Lynn, welcome back to Atheist Talk. And before we went to the break, we did have a question as far as how scientists perceive public science communications. Do you see it as a nuisance or a benefit?
Well, I think the questioner was absolutely correct that in his day, Carl Sagan was roundly criticized for drawing so much attention to himself and making the public aware of Carl Sagan, and maybe perhaps Sagan had to give up some of his research in becoming a popularizer of science. On the other hand, he leveraged his, because he was able to bring science to the public, and it's interesting because this month is the 30th anniversary of the Cosmos theories, and Cosmos brought science into more homes around the world than any other series before it, and perhaps any other series since. It's been in, as Carl would like to say, billions and billions of homes, billions and billions of people, but there is a role for people who are good communicators and good science communicators. Look at the other kinds of communicators and other scientists and other fields who have come since then. Oliver Sacks, E.O. Wilson, people like that. Look where we would be, how less rich we would be if we didn't have them talking to us about what they do.
Oh, Ira, when you mentioned E.O. Wilson, that was one of my most favorite shows recently when you had him on the air and talking about his recent novel. What an incredible scientist, and then he writes this beautiful fiction, which is a little bit autobiographical. So here's another question for you. How do you select the folks that you interview and talk to? Give me a little idea of the process, and there's so much information. It must be hard to make those choices.
Very hard. There are so many things going on at once. There are so many, there's been an explosion in two separate fields. One, of course, in the field of genetics and biology, and the other one now happening in nanotechnology, the world of the tiny, ultra small things that are going on. These two things didn't exist when I first started out as a journalist 40 years ago. So what we try to do each week is look through all the as many of the journals as we can, and we get to see previews of what the journals will have this week. We look through Nature and the Science and Chemical Society and the Public Library of Science and other places around there, and we try to figure out what stories, like we would do triage in a hospital, what stories are bleeding the most that week, what will be the most talked about stories, what will be the most important stories, and we try to put that into our into the mix. On the other hand, I'm a firm believer that if you just concentrate on these very popular stories, many of them are going to be picked up by the press anyhow, and there'll be other not so popular but very important stories that are going to be missed. And I believe that part of our mission at Science Friday is to find these little nuggets, these wonderful little stories that might be missed, and give them some light also. Because that's the public service that we do, is try to uncover things that and enlighten people about things that that might not ever get to see.
All right, I personally think that's the most important thing about your show, and it's the most notable, is that you do spread out the topics in a way that makes sense from the point of view of what's going on in science and not what's going on in newspapers. We had in Minnesota, we had a governor a couple of years back who advocated the dropping of funding for, I think it was public television, and he made the comment that if a television show or a radio show was worth anything, it would sell. It would sell products, ancillary products. It would make money. And that, in other words, the free market should decide what we see, which makes sense for certain things. But as you just pointed out, it doesn't make sense for science because there are important things.
Yeah.
A good example is probably, you know, when we discovered that one of our worst enemies in the disease world was actually a virus. It was kind of interesting at the time that very little research had been done on that because bacteria were what people were really trying to address. Basic science and the breadth of topics is what's most important. Do you have?
Let me comment on that for a second. Yeah. Because that's very true. Because if you take that logic to its extension, that the criticism that, you know, well, if it's, why should the government fund it? You could do away with the whole National Science Foundation, which is totally government funded, and which because of the NSF and National Institutes of Health, they fund things that companies aren't going to research. There's no money in them to do the basic research. They don't do basic research that way. Yet they take advantage of all that, the outcome, the results that come out of the NIH and the National Science Foundation. They're free to take that stuff. It's government-funded, you know, research, and then make products out of it. We wouldn't be having the kinds of advances in science and medicine because business is not interested, and it's not their job to do that kind of research, and none of those advances would happen.
And so now that we've just started to talk about funding, can you tell us a little bit more about how Science Friday is funded or what we can do, what people can do to help out? Just your thoughts.
Well, Science Friday is distributed by National Public Radio. Well, they're not called National Public Radio anymore. They took the word radio out of their name. They're called NPR now. And it's distributed by NPR and funded in a good part by public radio stations. A good quarter of the money that comes to Science Friday comes from public radio stations who decide to chip in with their own money and buy Science Friday. Then NPR gives us about 10% of our budget. And so between the two, we have about 35% of our budget. And the rest, you know, people say, what do you do the other 4 days of the week? I go out and try to find the money and the other resources.
Oh my gosh!
To keep us on the air. So we're always looking for underwriters, for corporations, foundations who believe in our mission. Because if we don't go out and find funding ourselves, we'll be off the air ourselves.
And I remember reading on your blog recently too, where you said to folks, support your local public stations, which is Minnesota
yes.
Public Radio. But you folks, you can go to sciencefriday.com, and there's a button there where you can donate. So you can certainly do both.
You can also, because the Minnesota Public Radio buys Science Friday, the money, if you tell them, you know, take this money and help Science Friday out, they need to get your funding also to purchase Science Friday. So it's good to go through those stations, too.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think that it's important. To me, it's important that the people in the boardroom or wherever it is are deciding these things at Minnesota Public Radio, NPR, which I guess is like IBM now. It only has initials. They have to, when someone in the boardroom pipes up and says, you know, our science shows are kind of costly. If we cut them back, we could do something else. People in the room should shudder, you know, because they should know that the listeners of public radio are, by and large, science hungry, and there's more geeks amongst us than among other audiences.
It's amazing. You know, people say, I get more requests for why can't you do Science Friday the other 4 days of the week also.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tremendous hunger. People want to know about, you know, science. They want to know. They're basically asking the same questions that philosophers have been asking for years. Where did we come from? Where are we going? And science, you know, science is basically trying to answer those same questions and explain getting, you know, what that line between A and B is, how we're getting there.
So everyone should get their checkbooks out now and donate. This is not a fundraiser, but that's what you should do anyway.
Fundraising week on public radio.
Right,
so.
It is absolutely. Yeah.
And it's always fundraising week on Atheist Talk, too, by the way.
So you guys are talking about, you know, the nuggets of little special nuggets and stories that you find that, you know, just isn't in the popular press. And the thing that I love, though, too, about this show is you get scientists are talking, and they run the gamut in personalities. You know, you've got the odd ducks, and you've got the ones who are articulate, and it's wonderful to hear brilliant minds speaking and with their personalities, and that's what I look forward to.
It's interesting that sometimes they don't go hand in hand. Sometimes people with brilliant minds are not great speakers. Many times they are. We talked about E.O. Wilson, we talked about Oliver Sacks, Carl Sagan, people like that. But sometimes people with brilliant minds have trouble getting their point across. For example, if we're talking about cosmology, where the universe is headed, what is it made out of, things like that. Dark matter, dark energy, with something now called dark flow, which is a spooky little thing about all this dark matter flowing in some direction in the universe. And it's not, you know, the modern theory says nothing should be flowing in any one direction in the universe. All the matter should be spread out evenly, you know, after the Big Bang. But there's this sort of wacky place in, you know, that some of this matter is heading. And if you try to interview people who are working in this field, sometimes they're not able to explain it very well. And if you're not a good communicator, it doesn't matter how much you know. At those times, we will find people and we know who they are, Michael Turner in Chicago, people like that, who are great explainers and have a knack about explaining it to the public. I always say this to scientists, and I say this to young scientists and graduate students. You have to learn how to be a communicator. You have to, you know, there are some people who are more talented at it than others. But it's sort of a craft that you can learn, and I think everybody needs to learn how to tell us what they do so that they, you know, if they want to stay a scientist, they can tell people why it's important.
One of my fellow science bloggers at Science Blogs, Matt Springer, makes the comment that if you have a theory of physics that explains everything, you have to have a valid mathematical formula to go along with it, which pretty much stops the people that write into his blog with their theory of everything that they got. Do you have, as running a show like yours, you must have a lot of people call in with theories that they have.
Well, we have a lot of people, yeah. Every week we get what I call the handwritten letter, long-form letter on four double-sided legal pages. Many of them are explaining why Einstein was wrong about relativity, their own theories of how the universe works. Some people have been trying to get their books published, and they're all, you know, they're all very interesting. But as going back to Carl Sagan, once again, he said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And so if you believe in the UFOs, if you believe in whatever, if you make an extraordinary claim, you'd better have some extraordinary evidence. If you want a paradigm shift in something to happen, you better have, you know, extraordinary evidence. You know, it's sort of like a global warming. There's extraordinary evidence for global warming.
All right.
There's extraordinary stuff showing you in the face.
Need to break in. Please stay with us through the break, and we'll return to Atheist Talk with Ira Flatow, Greg Layden, and Lynn Feldman. I'm Mike Harbeck, and you're listening to AM 950 KTNF, the voice of Minnesota.
Hi, my name is Mickey McCabe, and I'm the owner of Cucumbers Restaurant at 75th and Francine Dinah. If you've never been to Cucumbers, it's a buffet-style restaurant with a huge variety of salads, homemade soups, bakery items, and hot entrees that change daily and nightly. Plus our always fresh fruit and delicious ice cream. We're open for lunch and dinner, but Sunday brunch is my favorite time at Cucumbers. With scrambled eggs, waffles, French toast, bacon, sausage, baked ham, chicken fajitas, brunch potatoes, warm gooey cinnamon rolls, and many other items to choose from, it's no wonder why Cucumbers has always been a popular Sunday destination. So whether you're looking to skip Mass, someplace to go after Mass, or just great food to maintain your Mass, Cucumbers is the answer to your prayers. Bring in your church bulletin or Minnesota Atheist newsletter and receive a $2 discount off the buffet price. Cucumbers, one heavenly buffet at 75th and France in Edina.
I've never met another atheist.
Sure you have. Non-believers make up 12% of the population.
Then where are they?
You can meet us at book clubs, pub crawls, discussion groups, movie nights, monthly meetings.
Okay, I get it. How am I going to keep track of all this?
Easy. Sign up for Minnesota Atheist Meetup Group and subscribe to AWE.
What's a meetup group?
Meetup is an online networking site that helps people build communities. We have over 700 members with at least two events every week.
And what is AWE?
It stands for Atheist Weekly Email. It comes out every Friday and lists everything that's going on.
How do I sign up?
Go to the Minnesota Atheists website, minnesotaatheists.org. On the left, click on the words Get Awe-Inspired.
And for the meetup?
Look for the red meetup badge on the right. Above it are the words, click here to check out the meetup group.
I'm sold. Minnesota Atheists, Meetup, and AWE. What's that website again?
MinnesotaAtheists.org.
Thank you for tuning in to Atheist Talk on AM 950 KTNF, the voice of Minnesota. I am Mike Hobrick. Before we go back to Ira, Lynn, and Greg, I wish to thank our sponsors, Cucumbers Restaurant at 75th and Franson and Dinah, and the Humanists of Minnesota. We sincerely appreciate your support and the support of all our contributors, no matter how much you give. Our music is composed by member Brent Michael Davids. Also want to announce that there's brunch afterwards at Cucumbers, and they're one of our sponsors. Please join us. If you ask for the Atheist, they'll help you find us. On Saturday, October 30th, join us for deep baptism and breakfast, Bloody Mary's optional, at L. Baker's in Eagan. Watch the Rally to Restore Sanity or the Rally to Keep Fear Alive, whichever you choose, on big screen TVs. Details at meetup.com. Please visit the Minnesota Atheist website at mnatheist.org for more information on us and our events. Sign up for meetups, subscribe to the Atheist Weekly email, and become a member. And now, back to Ira, Greg, and Lynn.
Thanks, Mike. I just want to mention some of the blogs we've been talking about. You can go to minnesotaatheist.org and click on these links. We have them listed, but do visit sciencefriday.com. And another very good website is talkingscience.org. And that's handled by Anne-Marie Cunningham, who works with Ira, of course. And it's got terrific videos by Flora Lichtman. Ira, she's just a gem.
Terrific, yeah.
Yeah, and you and she together, when you're on Science Friday, have just a wonderful rapport. And just a few more things for folks to check out. You can also go to iraflato.com, and there's information there. There's information about Ira's book. And I want to say congratulations, too. You just recently got an award on the Nuremberg Prize, and that's for science in the public interest, and you'll be presented with that in November, I believe. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And you just did a presentation at TED in New York City, too, didn't you?
Yes, I did a local TED presentation in which I talked about science being sexy now, some of the things we were talking about. And one of the trends in science now is that girls and women, young women, are becoming very interested in science. And they are they're popping up in places that we always think that boys and men are popping up. For example, the 2010 winner of the Intel Science Talent Search is a woman, a girl, young woman, for her project. And 4 out of 10 of the finalists are women.
Oh, that's great.
And there's a trend of women in science that is slowly growing, but very evident.
Yeah, if we mix it up a little bit more, and scientists are cool, yeah, it'll be almost normal someday. So we'll watch for that. Maybe that link on your website for the TED talk, perhaps, or.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm waiting for they're digitizing the actual talk. So when it was webcast live, but they haven't got the recorded version of it yet. So when it's available, we'll put it on the website.
Okay. Yeah, folks, so watch for that. So Greg and I want to ask you, and Greg's going to take it from here, the question that you always ask your guests. Take it away, Greg.
Well, yeah, this is a question that I know that you ask your guests pretty habitually, and I'll rephrase it a little bit. As a science communicator, the question you usually ask, obviously, is to a researcher, if you had all the money you needed, what would you do? What I want to ask you is, what if you got a phone call from the producers at NPR that said, you got the 4 days. Or more specifically, not you necessarily, but we want 4 hours of science programming a week. It can be in 10-minute segments. It could be one big show, whatever. And you're the guy who's going to write the memo telling us what to do. What would that say?
Well, I have these ideas out. I think we could put science in many more places. We could create little drop-ins for public radio where, for example, people could listen to science, little science segments in Morning Edition. We could become part of Marketplace. We could have science as part of this radio station. We could create a weekend edition of Science Friday with different elements where commercial radio stations could actually play, you know, Science Friday segments, the whole or in part, and bring Science Friday out to commercial radio. We could create more podcasts. We could create more videos. We could get children and kids more involved. That's one thing we're trying to do on Talking Science as part of Science Friday, is have kids send us their videos, have teachers send us what projects the kids are doing in their science classes. We'll put them on our Talking Science website. We want to have kids talk to each other about science and share what they're doing. And there's a great potential for this, and now is the time to do this stuff.
Well, I think we should, again, get out your checkbooks and all this can be funded.
Well, yeah, if we get some grants from the NSF that we'd like to get, or from other underwriters or foundation people, we could do that. You know, the people we certainly won't turn down any support we get from the public. We're certainly hopeful for that.
Has your podcasting influenced your show or influenced your readership? I mean, you Science Friday is available by podcast, and I know people who only listen to podcasts. That's their only way that they get stuff, and that's actually would include me. I listen to Science Friday only on podcast because I'm never able to listen to it live. Yeah. Do you have, you probably researched this. I mean, do you have a sense for how important podcasting has been to
your show? We have over 20 million downloads of Science Friday every year. We have almost 2 million a month of people. And we, you know, in theory, we wouldn't even have to do a radio show and still have a popular podcast. And we could just put the podcast up on the website and have our own podcast show. We'll never want to do that. But we also have our video, as Lynn was saying, we have a video pick of the week. We create really unique science videos, fun, exciting ones that can be podcast also. People don't even realize they exist. Every time I talk to a school teacher or someone else, I say, "Have you watched our videos?" And it's very hard to get the word out that we have a video on our website, a new one each week, and you know, it could be put on your own page and updated automatically.
But somehow
we have an iPhone app.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
We have an iPhone app that you can take the videos of the podcast with you, you know, the audio podcast with you also.
I've got that on my touch. So somehow the live show actually is important to you, you think, as an anchor for this whole enterprise?
Well, there's nothing like radio. I mean, there can be podcasts, and can you listen to things, but I think the idea that you're sitting down and with a shared community of people and communicating to, you know, a thousand, a million people at the same time, it's like being around that old campfire and telling stories.
It's so true.
You know?
It's so true, Ira. And with that iPod app, you're really reaching out. Thank you very much. We're just about out of the time, and Mike's going to take it from here. Thank you, Ira.
All right. Thank you
very
much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And there is nothing like radio. Our engineer just saluted you, Ira. I would like to thank our audience for tuning to Atheist Talk. This is Mike Habrick, your host. Join us again next Sunday, October 31st, when our guest will be Tom Flynn. I'm happy to be on the air with Minnesota Atheists, and I hope that you appreciate the show. The show depends on the generous support of our members, our sponsors, and donors. Please consider supporting the show through the donation link at minnesotaatheist.org. This has been Atheist Talk on AM 950 KTNF, the voice of Minnesota. The podcast for the show will be on our radio page later today. Have a nice Sunday, everybody.